and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second beheading of an American journalist by ISIS, or the Islamic State, and speak with Dr. David Lesh, a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio and the author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad Question. We will discuss the mounting pressure on the Obama administration to employ military force against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and whether weakening ISIS in Syria will lead to the strengthening of the Assad regime's position in the ongoing civil war so that they could turn their attention to eliminating the US-backed Free Syrian Army. Then we'll assess the upcoming NATO summit in Wales, where there is expected to be an announcement of military budget increases from the member states and the formation of a NATO rapid reaction force. Jeffrey Mankoff, the Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program, and the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, joins us to discuss how much the tit-for-tat escalation in response to Russia's military aggression feeds into Putin's narrative that NATO is a military juggernaut heading east like the World War II Nazi panzers, instead of the worthless fictional paper tiger that the Polish foreign minister described it as in a private phone conversation. Then finally, we will look into voter suppression underway in Georgia ahead of a key Senate race in November that could determine whether the Democrats hold onto a thin majority or the Republicans take over the Senate with an equally thin majority. Lou DeBose, the editor of The Washington Spectator, where he has an article, Party of Lincoln Takes Aim at Black Voters, joins us to discuss how the Georgia GOP has rewritten voter ID laws as a hedge against the growing strength of minority voters who could determine whether Sam Nunn's daughter becomes Georgia's next senator and Jimmy Carter's grandson their next governor. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who is a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
And obviously, having a question after the fall of the House of Assad is important, since Hillary Clinton went out on a limb and basically said Assad's days are numbers. Now, of course, he's more or less hinting, not more or less, but pretty overtly hinting that, hey, well, I'm on your side now that you're going after ISIS. Obviously, that's not being treated seriously in Washington, or is it?
In terms of hitting ISIS?
No, of the idea that suddenly, because you know the enemy of your enemy is your friend, that the Assad, the foreign minister, was more or less saying now America's on our side.
That's a godsend for the Syrian government. I mean, this is kind of what they've been hoping for all along, either intentionally or unintentionally. Of course, you know, the narrative of the government was that they were terrorists from the beginning, and they engaged in some activities, obviously, that helped create reality of that narrative. And now it has come to pass, and now they want to be part of, the international response against ISIS. And of course, this is the problem. I mean, you had the Obama administration and President Obama himself in August 2011 saying it's time for Assad to step aside. So, there's no way that the United States, that is, the Obama administration, is going to, paint itself on the side of Assad, even though, in effect, as you said, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In this case, it's not a friend. It's a regime that we've committed to at least officially try to overthrow, but, of course, now realize it's not going anywhere. So it's quite the dilemma on how we are going to paint this, because I really do think that we will, at some point, with the proper preparation, and there's a lot of preparation that needs to be done, but I think that there will be airstrikes against ISIS positions in Syria, just on military grounds alone, because it's not going to work in Iraq if we just allow them this safe haven in Syria to retreat and regroup and so forth and so on.
So in response then to the beheading of the second American journalist, this time Stephen Sotloff, who appeared in the original video of James Foley as being the next victim, and there, of course, was a pretty profound reaction to the beheading of James Foley. In looking into that, a number of people have suggested that there's some ambiguity as to who was holding Foley in the first place, and also Sotloff. And as we know, the U.S. did have a rescue mission that failed, mainly because the intelligence wasn't there. So there were suggestions, for example, when the people that employed Foley, Global Post, they thought they were negotiating with Syrian Air Force intelligence who were holding him. So there are rumors that somehow a bunch of mercenary thugs picked him up or picked up these American journalists, sold them to Syrian Air Force intelligence, who in turn passed them on to ISIS to get the kind of propaganda boost that Assad thinks he's getting from this. So you've met with Assad and you know this regime. How does it operate on these various covert levels with apparently some kind of a relationship with ISIS? There have been many reports throughout this agonizing civil war that the Assad regime have been pounding the Free Syrian Army on one side of the street while ISIS fighters sit in a cafe on the other side of the street untouched.
Yeah, there's a lot of ambiguity. There are a number of hostages in Syria. There's one family that I've been trying to help who has a child who is hostage in Syria. And what's interesting is, you know, they have done an incredible amount of research into this, and they still don't know if the regime holds their child or if one of the radical Islamist groups. And they've had contact with both sides, and each says the other is holding them. And so I think this is emblematic of the complications in Syria regarding this. And the ambiguity surrounding the Syrian regime and their role in touting and perhaps, as according to some, even promoting or protecting some of the radical Islamist elements. Now, I think, you know, they're attacking what is the biggest threat to them. They're attacking the biggest ideological threat in terms of an alternative to what they can offer in terms of the Free Syrian Army and moderate groups. You know, it's very clear the line of attack against the Islamist groups. They are not going to retake some of the areas they controlled anyway. So I think that had to do with some of their military strategy over the past year or so. It's a very murky situation. And from the U.S. standpoint, as I said earlier, they don't want to seem to be the air force of the Syrian regime, just as Obama said we don't want to seem to be the air force of various Shiite factions in Iraq when we attacked ISIS positions there. So I think if and when we do intervene in some level, we're going to frame it in terms of protecting the regime, the government of Iraq we've been supporting. We're going to frame it within the context of protecting our allies, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and also our allies of moderate Syrian rebels in Syria, and also frame it within the context of degrading ISIS itself, but we will not frame it within the context of helping the Syrian regime.
So if, and I think you're correct in suggesting it's pretty inevitable that there'll be some kind of military bombing action against Syria, and it may be soon. The president's apparently has submitted a request to the Congress under the War Powers Act to do so. But my question in the opening was that if we weaken Syria, that will lead to the strengthening of Assad, and will he therefore turn his attention to eliminating the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army?
And that's a very real possibility. You know, at this point, it's a question of priorities. What is the lesser of two evils? And I don't see a satisfactory way out of this without at least tacitly allowing the Assad regime to continue or even strengthen its position if, in fact, we see ISIS as the problem. I think one of the ways to deal with this, and I hope the Obama administration, I think they are trying to approach it in this manner, is to approach the whole ISIS problem and dilemma in a comprehensive fashion. I mean, the reason there's something such as ISIS that came about is because there's two failed states in Iraq and Syria, because there are regional international powers that have taken advantage of the failed states in Iraq and in Syria in supporting different groups against each other. I really think, and this is actually the French, I believe, made a suggestion along these lines, is to hold an international conference to develop a comprehensive plan at the international, regional, and domestic levels to get all of these powers on board, also Iran, in order to develop a regional international strategy to deal with ISIS. And a component of this may be to try to once again develop in a creative fashion a political settlement, not only in Iraq, which I think is on its way with the removal of the Maliki government, but also in Syria, to help generate some sort of political settlement, very hard in and of itself. But I think now there's an urgency. This is one of those few occasions where perhaps the military leading the way toward political creativity and the political energy and will to develop some sort of settlement in Syria between a government that may or may not include Assad and those elements that we deem as moderate, such as the FSA and elsewhere, in helping to strengthen them politically in basically outmaneuvering and outflanking ISIS, because ISIS in Syria, you know, they're made up of so many individuals that have left the so-called moderate groups for money, because they have weapons and ammunition, because they offer positions, because they offer an opportunity to actually gain militarily against the government. So I think if there's a viable alternative, if there's a viable hope future in both Iraq and in Syria, that will, over the long term, weaken ISIS more than any airstrikes or bombs could do from the United States or its allies.
So when the president recently said that they don't have a strategy yet for ISIS, to combat ISIS, obviously those ill-chosen words, and they were jumped on, but it nevertheless, it's pretty much what you're saying, that, you know, and that may have been what the president meant, because I noticed that the deputy foreign minister of Iran met a couple of days ago in Saudi Arabia. And they're pretty much mortal enemies. They're the two, you know, they're in a proxy war in both Iraq and in Syria. So, is there what you're suggesting? Do you think it's somewhat in the works?
I think there are tentative signals, and there have been even before ISIS, because I think many have realized that the best way to resolve the situation in Syria, again, even before the rise of ISIS, was to get Iran and Saudi Arabia on the same page. Difficult. In under the best of circumstances, but there have been steps, you know, along those lines, pushed by the U.S. on the Saudi side and Russia on the Iran side to make some moves towards some sort of regional détente that would ease the pressure on Syria. Now, I think this is more necessary than ever, but it has to be, I think, region-wide and also international. There has to be some sort of conference. As you said, I mean, Obama was brutally honest and probably wrongfully honest in terms of political capital and saying there's not yet a strategy, but it's true. There's not yet a strategy because it has to be developed. Our intelligence assets in Syria are virtually non-existent, which is why perhaps, as you said earlier, we missed on the occasion of trying to rescue the hostages. So it's very sketchy, our intelligence there. And we have to develop all of these things before we engage in any sort of military response, but ultimately we can bomb ISIS out of existence if we wanted to, if we really wanted to. But all that's going to come up is what's going to happen afterward. There has to be a long-term political settlement to this at domestic, regional, international levels, or else just another form of ISIS will arise in the vacuum of power we create once again with military might. So there has to be a comprehensive solution that may, yes, include airstrikes, but also must include well thought out and planned comprehensive strategy for the future that takes into account the domestic, regional, and international dimensions.
Well, when you have, as you pointed out, two failed states, Iraq and Syria, and of course failed states become magnets for jihadis and all kinds of mischief. What is the incentive? I mean, there's a natural incentive on the other side because of so much destruction. This is a state that's been destroyed. And you know, heritage sites like the Aleppo Ancient Market have been all but destroyed. I think a third of the population has been displaced in Syria. And Iraq, of course, has had this long agony. But Iraq does have oil. But in Syria's case, would it be some kind of an agreement where the Saudis have the checkbook and the Iranians have the ability to get Assad to compromise? Is that the contours of a deal?
Yeah, it's the ideal scenario. Again, it's a lot of people say that is what will need to happen. Getting there is a great difficulty, and it will take a huge paycheck from the entire international community, not just the Saudis. They're said that I think conservatively some $200 billion with a B. Dollars worth of damage in Iraq, and it will take a generation, if the war stopped just today, to get back to the conditions which weren't ideal to begin with and which helped cause the uprising in the beginning, just to get it back to, you know, April or March 2011 before the uprising even began. So it's going to take a monumental effort, which is why I think you need the international community on board in a comprehensive sense, not only politically, but economically. And it's going to take a long time. There's no short solution to this. And I think even before ISIS came about, there was no short-term solution. This is going to take a long time. It's going to take incremental progress. It's going to take a lot of patience. It's going to take creativity. And it's going to take the cooperation of many of the powers in the region with whom the U.S. has not worked, such as Iran. And perhaps if there is a deal on the nuclear issue with Iran, maybe one of the positive repercussions could be some sort of cooperative effort, which, you know, to this point has been tacit in Iraq. Maybe it'll be more open not only there but also in Syria.
So when you talked about the $200 billion being needed for reconstruction, you meant for reconstruction of Syria, not Iraq.
Correct. Yeah, just Syria.
Syria. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Dr. David Lesh.
No, it's been my pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian foreign policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad Question. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the upcoming NATO summit in Wales. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeffrey Mankoff, who's a Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russia relations at the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Mankoff.
Thanks.
And on the eve of the NATO meeting in Wales, at which President Obama will be meeting with the NATO members, there's clearly a great deal of concern about what's happening in Ukraine, probably not helped by the remarks attributed to President Putin, leaked from a private conversation he had with José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission, saying, if I want, I will take Kiev in 2 weeks. Let's start with that. Of course, on the Russian side, they haven't denied it happened. They're just saying that it's a sort of
taken out of context.
Taken out of context, and it's kind of tacky for, to do that in terms of revealing the contents of a private diplomatic conversation. So,
right, and something the Russians would never do, of course.
So what's your sense of where this is heading? It seems to me that the destabilization of Ukraine is a given, and it will continue. But now the reports from the meetings in Minsk with the separatists are saying that they'll settle for a kind of not full independence, but some form of autonomy. And clearly they would not be acting on their own. So is this the latest gambit in this good cop, bad cop game that's going on?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. Part of the problem is that we've heard a lot of different things coming out of particularly Moscow, but also out of the rebels since all of this started. And I think that multiplicity of voices and sometimes deliberate obfuscation means that it's hard to take at face value a lot of these pronouncements. In particular, I guess I would say that there have been a number of occasions where the government in Moscow has hinted that it was looking for a negotiated solution only to then step up the military intervention. So I don't know that the latest remarks by the separatist leadership in Donetsk and Luhansk signify much of anything. I mean, I think all along there's been a political component to this crisis in the sense that obviously Russia is looking for some kind of a political deal that secures what it sees as being at least its minimum interests. But I think a lot of what actually is going to happen is going to be determined by the facts on the ground. So I wouldn't put too much confidence in what the rebel leadership is saying. You know, certainly, I don't think we've seen any diminution of the fighting or of the Russian involvement in it. And so without that, you know, I think right now we have to assume that this is all just part of the larger campaign to secure what Russia sees as its interest in the conflict.
But every time the Ukrainian military makes any kind of advances, Putin matches them with upping the ante, either supplying better equipment or, in the most recent case, sending in active duty Russian forces. So, So you have to assume that because it's so calibrated, that this is what, you know, turning the screws are or keeping a finger on the screws. So why is he saying, for example, that he can do business with Poroshenko? At the same time, what appears to be the case is that he's not going to relent until basically that they cry uncle, the Ukrainians.
Yeah, well, as far as Poroshenko goes, he's a post-Soviet oligarch. He's somebody who both literally and figuratively, I think, speaks the same language as Putin and a lot of the Russian elite. And so I think by doing business with him, they mean that he's somebody who will see reason, as the Russians define it, eventually, and will seek some kind of a political solution rather than, you know, try to be a hero or a martyr. But of course, his willingness to do that, again, is going to depend on how events on the ground turn out. And to this point, the Ukrainian military, I think, has performed better than the Russians expected it to, and had the rebels pretty well on the verge of defeat prior to the direct Russian military intervention. And had Moscow been able to secure what it saw as its political aims without that direct intervention, I'm sure they would have done it.
So what can the leaders of NATO come up with in Wales? They're talking about a 5,000-man rapid reaction force, which doesn't sound like it would amount to much. Already you have NATO and Russia sharing borders with Poland and Kaliningrad and with Estonia and Latvia. So it's nothing new that they share borders. But my sense is, from talking to people in Moscow, is that NATO is the best excuse the Russian generals have for getting their budgets, because it's the old Cold War enemy, and it's basically harmless, but it provides the pretext for them fattening their budget and putting stars on their chest.
Yeah, I am sure that that is true. And it works both ways, I would say. At the same time, I think the professional military people understand what NATO is and what its objectives and capabilities are. But in the political and elite and more broadly, I think there is a view of NATO as being a kind of threat of one sort or another. If you look at the strategic documents produced, for example, by the general staff, they have the military doctrine, which came out 4 or 5 years ago, and it says that NATO's expansion and the globalization of its mission represents a danger to Russian interests, which in their typology is lower than a threat, but is still singled out as being something that is damaging to Russian interests. And I think there is still very much a kind of Cold War mentality about what NATO is, what its mission is, and why it exists. And primarily, when Russians look at NATO, what they're concerned about, what they're looking at, is the U.S. component. And they've spent a lot of time and effort over the years, and this goes back to the Cold War days, trying to split the U.S. and Europe, trying to drive a wedge between them. Because if they're dealing with the Europeans on their own, most of the Russian elite, I think, is pretty confident that they can overawe them. But when the U.S. is involved, and when the U.S. has a commitment, which it is willing to back up to provide security for its European partners and allies, then that acts as a constraint on what Russia can do in Europe and around its own borders.
But Jeffrey Mankoff, what does that agreement or that commitment from the U.S. as the head of NATO mean when you have conflicting statements, for example, in the secretly recorded tape recording of the Polish foreign minister at a restaurant quite near the Russian embassy in Warsaw? The foreign minister is heard to say that NATO is worthless. Membership doesn't mean anything. And he characterizes his relationship, or Poland's relationship with the United States, in the manner in which Monica Lewinsky has become famous for. And then you have, in contrast to that, you have on the BBC today, the Prime Minister of Estonia saying that NATO is robust and Article 5 is alive and well, that meaning that the member states will come to the rescue of anybody that's attacked. Article 5, in fact, was used by NATO to get NATO involved in Afghanistan because of the 9/11 attack on the United States. So how do you navigate between those two conflicting visions of how what NATO means to its member states, particularly those sharing borders with Russia?
Well, one, of course, was for public consumption and one was not. And as far as the one that was not for public consumption, the one that had a little more of the Monica Lewinsky to it, as you might say. You know, look, I think what's happened in Ukraine over the last 6 months has been pretty shocking to a lot of people in Europe and in the United States, less so to those in Eastern Europe. But I think what it's doing is forcing a rethinking of NATO capabilities and missions. And you've seen a lot of this in the language that Rasmussen has used in talking about the new era in Russia-NATO relations, how you can't operate on the assumption that Russia is going to be a partner anymore, which has been the basis for how NATO and Russia have interacted, or at least how NATO has interacted with Russia for, I mean, really the better part of the last two decades. Now, the real question is, how does that recognition translate into capabilities? And here, I think there's still a fine line that the alliance is trying to walk for a couple of reasons. One, because investing in these capabilities is going to be expensive. And, you know, we know that most of the NATO member countries are falling far short of their commitment to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Now, that I think will change after the Wales summit. But also because there's a fear on the part of a lot of the European NATO members about doing things that are going to be seen as overly provocative to Russia, which is one of the reasons that there hasn't really been much in the way of deployments or planning for defending the Eastern members. But there's kind of a catch-22 that's emerged over the last 6 months, which is that if you don't prepare for those things, I think that increases the sense of vulnerability on the part of those countries and increases the perception that Russia is taking advantage of the lack of preparation to actually push the envelope in terms of its own goals and aspirations. So you actually have to take some of these steps, which are seen as being provocative in order to provide both reassurance and deterrence.
But my understanding is that in the real world, the real levers of power now have largely become, in other words, the Treasury, in effect, U.S. Treasury Department has more levers of power than the Pentagon in their ability with the SWIFT system and to cut off Russia. They did it with Milosevic, for example. So that leads me to the question about Germany's role. Germany has really developed very good relations with Russia over the years, particularly economic integration. And after all, the German tanks were almost at the gates of Moscow. And that's the memory that drives these generals into their delusion that, that NATO is coming after them again, just like the Nazis did. And my understanding is that Merkel and company are very depressed about what's happened. They don't want this whole situation to go to hell, but it's heading that way. So what do you think the Germans can do as a key member of NATO and as a key economic partner with Russia?
Yeah, well, the Germans are at the center of a lot of this, and they're at the center of it both because they're the largest economy in Europe and also because historically, going back at least to Willy Brandt in the 70s, they've been the Russia whisperer, I guess. They've been the member of the Western coalition that's been able to have the best relationship with Moscow and to act as a kind of interlocutor between the West and Moscow. And that's been a very lucrative position for Germany to be in. That is becoming, that role is becoming less and less feasible all the time. And I think there are going to be real costs to German companies and to the German economy as a result. Now, you know, Germany in military terms has always punched significantly below its weight because of its own historical legacies from the Second World War, and there's still a very strong anti-militarist, anti-nationalist streak in Germany. That, I think, is changing as the generations change. But what's changing more slowly is sense that Germany can play this kind of special mediating role between the West and Russia. And that really is one of the sources of the discord in Europe, because the Germans don't want to be in that position where they feel that there's this zero-sum confrontation and they have to take sides. They're not the only ones. The French are in this position, too, with their warship sales, and the British with their financial links to Russia. But I think it applies to the Germans most starkly. And so, yes, there is going to be, I think, this sense of depression and this sense that the European security situation is not as benign as perhaps a lot of them had hoped that it would be. And I think the question now is how far are the Germans willing to go to shore up European and transatlantic unity? And on that score, I think Merkel has been pretty good. She faces a lot of domestic constraints in terms of both the federal structure in Germany, in terms of where a lot of the business elites are. But overall, I would characterize the evolution of at least the German government's views on this issue as being mostly in line with where the bulk of the other Western allies are.
Well, just in closing, Jeffrey Menkov, as much as we can understand about Putin, I mean, we know that he has absolute power, or not. He seems to have the kind of power that the Tsar used to have, and perhaps sees himself that way. He's surrounded by the Siloviki, the former intelligence guys. Those are his cronies. He kind of regulates the oligarchs. Supposedly, they're alarmed about what's happening, and they've seen their wealth diminish as this Russian stock exchange has gone into the toilet. But on the other hand, you know, how can he walk back? He can't sell out his proxies in Ukraine. He can't walk back from this massive, out-of-control propaganda machine that has the whole Russian people believing that the Nazis have taken over right. Ukraine and are heading their way. So in many ways, I think it's about who the guy is. You know, he's clearly a narcissist who likes to take his shirt off and show that he's got a black belt and all this kind of stuff. And the impression I get is that Obama just doesn't want to deal with him. And I don't think in foreign policy you have the luxury of that. So is there any way that the U.S. could just sort of swallow their pride and rather play the tit-for-tat game of increasing sanctions or increasing military confrontation to somehow come up with a bold initiative like Nixon did with China?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, first on the characterization of Putin, you know, I think there's one important difference between his role and that of let's say, the Tsars. And that is that the Tsars claim to rule by divine right. And, of course, that got them into trouble at some point because they thought they could get away with basically anything. And at some point, the public decided that it had enough. But for a long time, at least, they had that belief that was just fairly widespread to bolster their legitimacy. Putin can't do that, so he has to come up with other ways of legitimizing his rule, of getting support. And in the past, a lot of that has been based on economic performance. But the challenge now is that the economy, even without the effect of the sanctions, was beginning to slow down, was heading for recession. And so what is the alternative? Well, the alternative seems right now to be to embark on this kind of quixotic, romantic nationalist adventure in Ukraine to generate a kind of rally around the flag effect. But that's the ability to do that is limited, or it should be limited. I mean, what happens when this conflict is over and the economy still hasn't improved? I mean, I think he faces the same dilemma at that point. In terms of what the U.S. can do, I think you're right that we have an administration right now that is very reluctant to step up U.S. involvement overseas. Obama said on a number of occasions he was elected to end wars, not start them, that he wants to focus on nation building at home. And the public supports him in that. Unfortunately, the world beyond American borders has pretty important impact as well. You know, there's a pull factor overseas that things can happen in other parts of the world that affect American interests and American security, regardless of what the American public or the American political leadership would like to happen. And I think that's what we're seeing now in Ukraine, in Iraq, and elsewhere. And there has to be some kind of a response, or there are going to be serious costs for U.S. interests. Now, can Washington come up with some kind of grand bargain with Moscow to avoid escalating the conflict? I suppose they can, but the problem, I think, is that the Russians have figured out that this is an administration that doesn't have a lot of appetite for confrontation, which is not something that one would have said of the Nixon administration. So, you know, Nixon could get away with striking a bargain with China because I think everybody in Beijing, in Moscow, and elsewhere knew that he had the ability to act much more aggressively if this approach failed. Whereas I think with the current administration, the perception abroad, whether right or wrong, is that it's a weak administration, that it doesn't have any ability to back up its threats with force, and so it would be negotiating from a position of weakness. And certainly when you talk about Mr. riding around on horseback with his shirt off, I think the perception of weakness means that there's not a lot of appetite in Moscow to do that kind of deal, because the history of the last certainly 6 months seems to indicate that Russia can get a lot more of what it wants by stepping up confrontation rather than backing down from it.
Well, Jeffrey Mankoff, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Mankoff, who's Deputy Director and Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program. He's the author of Russian Foreign Policy, The Return of Great Power Politics, and is a frequent commentator on international security, Russian foreign policy, regional security in the Caucasus and Central Asia, ethnic conflict, and energy security. Previously served as an advisor on U.S.-Russian relations at the United States Department of State. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about voter suppression in Georgia ahead of a key Senate race.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lou DeBose, who's the editor of The Washington Spectator and co-author with the late Molly Ivins of two New York Times bestsellers about George W. Bush, Shrub, The Short But Happy Political Life of George W. Bush, and Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. He has an article at The Washington Spectator, Party of Lincoln Takes Aim at Black Voters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lou DeBose.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly, the issue of voter suppression, particularly if it is the Republican Party's policy, and in many ways, you could make the argument that the majority on the Supreme Court are Republican Party political operatives who have seen the writing on the wall with demographics and therefore decided that the only way to make the Republicans viable over the long term is with a combination of voter suppression and allowing billionaires to buy elections. But that aside, just focusing on what's happening in Georgia, how much have the voter the voter suppression ID laws at this point suppressed the likely black vote down there, which could be the deciding factor in the election of Sam Nunn's daughter to become Georgia's next senator and Jimmy Carter's grandson to become the next governor.
Yeah, you know, you have two brands running for it, two Democratic brands running in the state of Georgia. You know, and it strikes me, Ian, that, you know, I mean, I'm listening to what you just said, and I said, I would think, how absurdly conspiratorial does that sound? But it's just spot on. It is what the Supreme Court did. They dismantled Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and they gave states like Georgia incredibly broad discretion with no more preclearance, although this law passed when preclearance was required. It's a matter of demographics, as you said. It is the Republican Party holding the future at bay because they're not, as Lindsey Graham said, there are not enough angry old men being created to keep the party in business. So you go to Georgia, and Republicans are 31% of the population. They determine statewide elections. They're determinative. And they're growing. They're growing, you know, really fast. So in 2005, as soon as the Republicans controlled both houses and the governor's office, governorship, they pass a law that they pass one of the first two voter ID laws in the country, and they're ALEC bills. Both bills are an ALEC template. The American Legislative Exchange Council has drafted the bill. They came from out of nowhere, and they passed Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was still in place. These had to be pre-cleared by the Supreme Court, but you know, here we go down the what sounds like a conspiratorial rabbit hole. George W. Bush is president. Alberto Gonzalez is secretary, is attorney general. The Voting Rights Department of the Division of the Justice Department says these are retrogressive and would take us back to Jim Crow, and they're overruled, and the law is upheld. The law is pre-cleared by the Justice Department. That's moot now, of course, because you don't have to pre-clear. So you have the first voter suppression law, and as in all of these cases, not a single evidence of no proof whatsoever of ballot box fraud. So I mean, there you kind of have it.
Well, but let's talk about the figures then, Lou DeBose, in terms of the demographics. You say it's 30-something percent white Republican, and yet they have taken over the legislatures, the governorship, and they can have the two senators.
Right. Well, no, it's 31% black.
So 31% black. Okay.
Right. What much of this is about is breaking up coalitions of progressive of white liberals and black voters. So you know Georgia, you know, and the larger number is something like 38%, 45% non-white. The total non-white population is 45%. So white folks in Georgia are 5% away from being irrelevant because blacks, Hispanics, and Asians won't vote for them. So what they do is they pass voter suppression legislation like their Voter ID Act of 2005. Now, when it was challenged in court under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and under the 14th Amendment, they immediately came back and they included a poll tax in it. It would have cost a citizen of Georgia $20 to $35. To get a voter ID. You can only get them in 59 counties. There are 159 counties in Georgia. So when they saw a lawsuit coming, when they convened in 2006, they passed a second bill. They passed two voter ID bills. And the second one, they tossed the poll tax,
which, right.
and they put voter register voter ID offices in every county in Georgia. So then, you know, a federal judge thought that it was. I mean, who had intervened and stopped its implementation. So when they did that, the judge, Jimmy Carter, a nonagenarian judge, a Jimmy Carter appointee, comes in and says, well, this is okay, they fixed it. How fixed is it? You know, here are the numbers, and the numbers are really critical here. The Department of Transportation said that there were more than 800,000 Georgians of voting age who did not have driver's license. And the driver's license is the key to voting. Otherwise, you got to go out and get a license. Now, so 800,000 people who don't, 800,000 Georgians, most of them poor, most of them minority, who don't have driver's license. So they're required to go get a voter ID from the state. And this law has been in effect since 2006. So let's say then Governor Sonny Perdue, not David Perdue, who's running for the Senate, but his relative Sonny Perdue, who was supporting the bill, he said it would disenfranchise potentially 300,000 Georgians. Well, only 300,000, right? But the Department of Transportation said it could potentially disenfranchise 850,000. Well, elections in Georgia, statewide elections, are won by an average of 260,000 votes. And since that law was passed, only 33,000 people have actually gone out and applied for a photo ID. So, you know, pick a number. You know, take Sonny Perdue's number. Take it on faith, although it's completely bogus and understated. It's 300,000 people who won't have the proper ID. Take the Department of Transportation, the U.S. Transportation Department, 875,000, right? Only 33,000 of those pools of voters, potential voters, showed up to get a voter ID. So you've either eliminated 270,000 or you've eliminated what? 840,000 voters, most of whom are minorities. They've achieved their objective.
So, given what you've just told us, Lou, that they essentially have succeeded, the GOP in Georgia, in suppressing the vote, and that only 33,248 Georgians have received the official voter ID card under this new law, and that there's 174,420 of driving age Georgians who don't have driver's license, most of whom are African Americans. What are the Democrats doing to get out the vote? Because if they lose, if they've already not going to win those three seats, we know. I think that's pretty clear that the Republicans are going to pick up three Senate seats. You know, what I can't remember the states now: Montana, Idaho, I think West Virginia. Right. So you've only got the possibility of Sam Nunn's daughter Michelle winning in Georgia. To hold right. the line, they're not. McConnell's now ahead, according to the latest polls, of Grimes in Kentucky. So it's not looking good for the Democrats, and she's their firewall, Michelle Nunn, isn't she?
She is their firewall, and you know, again, we're talking about 870,000 votes or 300,000 votes. You know, one figure or the other, but they were wiped from the voting rolls by this, and only 33,000 voters who've gone to the county offices and paid to do it. What's happening, there are a number, you know, here's the amazing thing. There are 700,000 unregistered black voters in the state of Georgia. You register 60% of them and you turn the state Republican. There are a number of voter registration efforts frantically trying to get voters registered. And then the second step is to get them to the poll. And, you know, you're right, Ian. This is the firewall. She's Michelle Nunn is a centrist. She's running away from Obama. She's worked in the nonprofit sector for the, you know, for the George Bush's, you know, points of 1,000 Points of Light Foundation. George H.W. Bush, the senior Bush. So, you know, she has the proper profile to win a statewide election in in Arizona.
But Lou, she doesn't have the profile to inspire African Americans to come out to vote, does she?
That's a great question, and this is where we always fall short with candidates, isn't it? Only with winks and nods. You know, only if they there are three or four large turnout the vote efforts. You know, let me step back to one thing that I omitted. You know, they passed this law. The Republicans, when they took control, they passed it in 2005, and then lo and behold, Obama wins 47% of the vote in Georgia in 2008, and they go into panic mode. So what they do is. I mean, these their cult, their institutional intelligence is exceptional. So okay, they realize that the way Obama won that many votes, you know, black president coming close to within 3% of a majority in the state of Georgia, he did it because there was a 45-day voter registration period. So their second corrective, what happened in 2013. They're the Republicans, and they passed. They cut voter registration dates from 45 to 18 days. Huge. So you know, it's like these guys stay up at night. You know, I don't know. When I was in high school, it's been a while. You know, we were taught that voting was your great civic responsibility. You should get everyone to vote. And this entire movement is aimed at. It really is aimed at. Holding the future at bay. So there are about five Democratic registration and turnout the vote movements on the ground now. One is directed by the Speaker of the House, an African-American woman by the name of Stacey Abrams. League of Women Voters is registering voters, the Democratic Party, outside the campaigns. They're a group of nonprofits, and it's a race against the calendar to turn out, to get enough registered Democrats on the rolls.
Right, but it also takes time to get a driver's license, doesn't it? I mean, it takes time and money. If you've got 700,000 unregistered African-American voters in Georgia, they haven't tapped into this pool, and it takes the time and it takes money. But the one thing that seems to be happening in this country, and I'm surprised that there isn't more activism amongst the African-American community in Georgia, and that is if you've got Trayvon Martin, you've got what happened in Ferguson, what more do you need to get people motivated? What people in Ferguson realized after this thing happened is that the entire county government is white, and the school board is white, and the entire police force is almost as white. So those
in
a quick 30-second answer. Sorry.
30 seconds. I just got back from Ferguson, and I was standing with a state senator, a black woman, African-American woman, and I said, how does this happen with voting? And she said, look, they got me. I'm black. They got a black president. They got black congressmen. And these kids are still living here in the same circumstances they've known since they were born. And there's not much enthusiasm about voting because they don't believe it makes a difference. How you crack that nut is the secret to restoring democracy in what once was a democratic country.
Well, Lou DeBose, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for the opportunity, and it's been a while.
Well, we'll do it again. And again, I've been speaking with Lou DeBose, who's the editor of The Washington Spectator and co-author with the late Molly Ivins of two New York Times bestsellers about George W. Bush, Shrub, The Short But Happy Political Life of George W. Bush, and Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. He has an article at The Washington Spectator, Party of Lincoln Takes Aim at Black Voters. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm